Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Want to welcome you all to the show tonight. Hope you've had a good week. We're having a visitation of Winter, who my guest in just a few moments, originally, I believe, came from the Philly area, so he knows all about this kind of thing, but was wise enough to move to California. So, for anyone new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We recovery program because it is in the We that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. So, this is the last night of Brain Injury Awareness Month. I'm going to be bringing on our guest, Leonard Bushell, in just a couple of minutes. But first, Leonard was kind enough to allow me to have Michael, who many of you know. He's been a loyal listener for over a decade, and he's been working on something. There's going to be a ribbon cutting next week, so it's really a big deal. And we're going to have him come on first and just tell you a little bit about his project. And then I will be bringing on Leonard. And then after that, I'll have some open time for any callers who would like to call in tonight on this last day of Brain Injury Awareness Month, who might have anything they'd like to say in regard to their injury. With that, I'm going to bring on Michael. Michael, welcome to the show. I'm so happy you could be here to tell us about your success tonight. And your success is a gift to everyone who's going to be able to enjoy the fruits of your hard work.
Thank you very much, Kim. Hello, audience. I'm Michael. I've been listening a long time, since 2013. And I'm doing something very special here in Pinellas County. I'm the brainchild behind it. That's what they all say. I say, just let's do what I'm doing. And I like to read you my speech first off. And then I'd like to talk about it for a little while, about what I'm going to do. Is that okay, Kim?
You bet.
Okay, thank you. Here's my speech that I'll be reading next week at my ribbon cutting ceremony on Madeira Beach in Pinellas County, Florida. People come from near and far to enjoy Tampa Bay beaches. Moby mats are a non-slip permanent pathways to the beach safely and easily for people with disabilities and our aging community. According to CDC, 28% of adults in Florida live with a disability and mobility challenges. 30 parks already have these Mobi mats installed, and only 4 mats installed in Pinellas County. I want to change this forever. And the 4 mats are installed because I asked to have them installed. I've been working on it 4.5 years to get them installed. Well, they're finally starting to get installed, as I said. Think of how many children, veterans, and civilians alike would be able to take these mats down to the water and sit with their families in wheelchairs and comfortably enjoy the beaches of Pinellas County. And that's my speech. That's what I'm going to say. And then I'm just going to talk a little while about these beautiful mats that are, these mats go from the end of the cement, maybe out 30 to 40 feet, and come with wings on them, which are little things off the ends, which allow people to ride out on, if you're in an electric wheelchair, which a lot of, and believe it or not, I'm in it sometimes, which are a lot of people are in Pinellas County, through epilepsy, through veterans and all. Well, you can wheel, or you can carry out a carry-all chair and sit on these wings and be totally to the side of the mats. And these mats are so beautiful if you think of these poor children and veterans that had to sit on the cement and just look at people on the beach that couldn't get their chairs or, you know, got their disability anyway, couldn't get onto the beach because the sand was too soft. And, well, if a chair ever tried to get on the beach, it'd sink 1, 2, 3, and it would go nowhere.
Right.
So this is what
right.
This is what I'm doing, and I'm really looking forward to getting them. They'll be throughout Pinellas County. We'll be the
yes.
friendliest county for people with disabilities in the whole United States, I hope, by the time I'm done. And I have full backing of all the mayors along the beaches. And I have full backing of a very nice foundation that's going to totally back me in this. And I have full help with going through everything through the Disability Achievement Center in this county, which is helping me tremendously. They're doing all the paper because I am just like you. I have a terrible brain injury from a long, long time ago. I was only 10. But what I say is, look what God has done for me now. I've always stayed positive about things. Someone ever asked me, I said, well, I was in an accident. I never explained that accident. And I'm Sicilian, so people... If I make a face, I guess it's not too nice, and people don't press me for it. But that's just how you should. That's just how all the listeners should be too. So always stay positive. I know it's hard because I've been through it. I could tell you it's been real hard some days. And I'm an author, and I wrote my first book And I explained how I used to sit in the corner, come home from school, sit in the corner and just cry sometimes because it was so hard. But never give up. I always tell everybody, never give up. Just look up to the sky and pray a little, and your dreams will come true. And I'm just about, I'm just about done, Tim. I could go on, but I don't want to bull on. I'm not a bull on here. I think I said everything I wanted to say and read everything I wanted to read. Thank you.
I'm so happy that you did, and congratulations on all of your hard work, and I'm delighted to see it come to fruition, and so are all the people that are going to be coming down to Pinellas County now. For their vacationing. What a gift. I appreciate your perseverance after all these years and getting this done, from the idea to the first mat, to going out and selling it to the board, to getting the funding, and now having them all over down in Pinellas County. That's just a wonderful thing.
Can
it would be very frustrating.
Can I say one more thing? I was told this morning, which I didn't even, I forget to say this, I'm sorry, but next week on Pinellas County websites, Pinellas County, Florida websites, there will be a whole thing about the Pinellas County beaches and how they're all getting these Moby mats in and these chairs in, you know, for access for people with disabilities and all. So all that your listeners have to do is look up Pinellas County, Florida next week, and there'll be a whole explanation about these Moby mats going in.
All right. I'll put a note on the, if you, we'll talk and I'll find that link and post it on Brain Injury Radio so everybody can see it as soon as it comes out. And I appreciate you coming on and telling us about it tonight, and good luck at the ribbon cutting next week.
Very good. Thank you, Kim. I dearly appreciate it.
All right. Me too.
Okay.
All
thank
right.
You. Bye.
You bet, Michael. Good night. Okay, everyone. That was a longtime listener, Mike Ciafone, and he started out putting access ramps onto houses for people. Came up with the idea for the Moby mats, made the first one, and then pitched it to the city council, the disability board, and they went for it. He got the funding, and they're going to be all over. I can't imagine. We take for granted being able to walk down to the beach and feel the spray of the ocean water and to be there and not be able to do that is hard, sad, and Michael's found a solution for that. And so very proud of him for his perseverance and all the things he's done to help the community over the years. So way to go, Michael. And I'm glad that he stopped on tonight to give us the heads up that the ribbon cutting is going to be next week. And I'll be sure to get that link out so you guys can read about it after the ribbon cutting. With that, I'm going to get to our guest who had some oral surgery today. I feel bad for him, but he was willing to come on. You know, survivors are a tough lot of people. Leonard Bushell is a Philadelphia native. Nearly terminal brain tumor survivor, among other things, and a very happy Los Angeles transplant now. He is California certified substance substance abuse counselor with years of experience working with people struggling with addiction. Mr. Bushell is the author of the recently published autobiography recovery memoir, High, Confessions of a Cannabis Addict. He attended Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. Mr. Bushell is the founder of Writers in Treatment, whose primary promote treatment as the best first step solution for addiction, alcoholism, and other self-destructive behaviors. Leonard is the director of the 13-year-old Real Recovery Film Festival and Symposium, and for 9 years has been the editor-publisher of the weekly Addiction Recovery e-Bulletin. He also directs and produces the annual Experience, Strength, and Hope Awards in Los Angeles. For more on Leonard, and I put this in the program notes, he's got a couple different websites. Leonard Bushell, and that's B-U-S-C-H-E-L. Again, it's in the program notes if you're not by a pen, and I will be mentioning it throughout the show, .com. And another website is addictionrecoverybulletin.org. I encourage you to sign up for that, and realrecoveryfilmfestival.org. Now, his book is shown in the link to Amazon where his book is located on his leonardbushell.com site. With that, I'm happy to bring on Leonard and see how he's feeling tonight after his ordeal today. Welcome to the show, Leonard. Happy to have you here tonight.
Hi, Kim. It's great to be here. Am I coming in loud and clear?
Yes, you are. You sound great.
Wonderful. First, I want to say thank you for inviting me to be on the show. And I want to give my commend Michael on the work he's doing, which sounds, you know, brilliant, fantastic, and obvious, and I hope he gets acknowledged and appreciated for years and years to come. That's the kind of thing that outlasts him as a great service.
Yes.
to the community that is too often overlooked. So I'm
absolutely
proud, I'm proud to share this airspace with Michael, and the oral surgery went very well. I don't remember a lot of it because they actually forced me to take a Halcyon before it happened. And I did.
Oh, jeez.
And that's, you know, I don't want to talk about my teeth on the radio. I want to use them to enunciate every word I have to say and to speak more slowly than I usually do, because I think it's important to, like I said, enunciate and relate my tales that might be of interest or useful to other people. And thank you for mentioning the book. I'll just mention it one more time because I'm not a real huckster, but I was told to mention that Confessions of a Cannabis Addict is available on Amazon, and it's also available from Barnes & Nobles. I think Barnes & Nobles, you have to order it, and Amazon, you can press 3 buttons and have it delivered in 2 days. So I'm very proud of it. It took me 10 years of spilling my guts, examining my life, and which is not always a pleasant, happy thing to do, especially when the life has been so filled with ups and downs. I was going along really well for 3 weeks. I was like, oh my God, I was the happiest baby in Philadelphia. And when I hit that 3-week mark, my father was taken from me by a heart attack. And he died, and my mother went a little insane, grief-stricken, horrified that she had me as a three-week-old, and my brother was 3 years old at that time, and she was suddenly, in a moment, left without her husband, without her breadwinner, without her man, without the father of her two children. So you can imagine, you can imagine what that did to her psyche. There were no grief support groups at that time, and I, on a cellular level, knew that my life had changed forever. In fact, I sort of did a mind experiment. When my son was 3 weeks old, I imagined, suppose I died and he never got my love, my affection, having catches, teaching him how to ride a bicycle, all those things that you just accept as that a father does. And I imagine that if I died when he was 3 weeks old, how incredibly different his life would have been without me. And I realized, wow, that's me. That's me who lost my father when I was 3 weeks old, thereby growing up in a completely different environment or atmosphere than I would have if I had had two parents, especially my dad. On the upside of that, I never got mixed signals from my parents. I never asked one for something and got said no to and then, you know, ran to the other parent and, you know, tried to finagle that thing. My father never told me one way to do things, with my mother telling me the opposite way. I got all my messages were very clear, but they were all from a woman. And a woman, I don't think, can teach you, you know, how to fix a flat tire. I think the reactions to getting a flat are different than a man would be. You know, a woman says, oh, my God, I got a flat tire. What do I do? A man jumps out, gets the jack, and fixes the tire. Or when the spare room needed painting, you know, he would just whipped out the gotten the paint and done it. So I sort of feel that I grew up as like a plug, but with only one spong, one what's it called on a plug? The two metal things. I'm losing words here, but that does happen ever since my you know what. Prong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Only one prong. And
yes.
And so I'm not saying that I'm unbalanced, but sometimes I think maybe that's why I took to a life of drugs, drug usage, and drinking, maybe more than someone else. Although I know a lot of people, obviously, who had two parents who also became drug addicts. But I think everybody has a little bit of a different reason. And I think one is that I was felt an imbalance. And the first hit of marijuana I took, suddenly my life went from black and white to color. And the next day I thought, oh, my life is so black and white. But if I smoke some marijuana, it turns back into color. And I like black and white movies, but I didn't like a black and white life. And about 10 years after my first joint, I had my first line of cocaine. And then my life went from color to Technicolor 70 millimeter, three-dimensional. It was another jump in consciousness. Of course, it doesn't last forever. And eventually, you know, the marijuana that gave me wings eventually took away the sky, and it takes a while to notice that you're no longer perceiving things better and more clearly than you did before the first hit of marijuana. You're now seeing things through a filter, you know, through a gauze, through a cloud of smoke, if you will. And I can't say I remember when that happened, but I do remember always wearing rose-colored glasses, you know, those sunglasses, not dark, but those just gave the world a little bit of a rosy glow, because that's what happened every time I smoked pot for the first 10 or 15 years. And then, as I said, it gives you wings and then takes away the sky, and then you're just hovering, and you're not really proceeding in a G-O-D, good orderly direction. You're just sort of hanging like the famous blimp, a Goodyear blimp.
Yes.
It's just like the Goodyear blimp. Like, you're big, but you're not really going far. You're not going fast. And, you know,
right. Usually
when you're young, you want to go far and fast, or at least I did, having been born in the month of December on the same day as Frank Sinatra, December 12th.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, not the same year, but December 12th. You, as a Sagittarian, you're given this desire to travel and to become intellectually curious about a lot of things and a lot of people. And you know, the marijuana actually helped me with that initially, and then it didn't, and then it stopped. And at some point, I'd like to read a little from my book, Kim, if you don't mind.
I don't, but could I ask you a question first, and
of
then
course.
Put your finger on what you're going to read?
Okay.
I was just going to say, going back to growing up without a father, and it seems like we see this a lot, and in fact, my guest 2 weeks ago had this situation in New York. Philadelphia's, if it was in Philly, that's a pretty big city, and even in the case of my father, whose dad just simply took off when he was five, so he was raised by a mother and had older
mm-hmm.
sisters, it seems that the streets seem to be where young men pick up their male influence, and that's not, you know, now as it turned out with my dad, a coach was the angel that stepped in and helped redirect him, and my guest a couple of weeks ago, it was a Monsignor that, you know, was his saving grace. But before that, you know, with mom working to support the kids, being left in that sudden shift,
uh-huh. yes,
you know, her not being in the same place emotionally, psychologically as she was before, and not able to be readily available like moms were a lot of the time, that kind of left kids on their own, and, you know, particularly young men with the influence of other young men who are hanging on the street corner.
That's what happens a lot of times.
That's what I was going to ask you, because it seems like a lot of times things like drugs, gambling, whatever it might be, that
criminal
is
behavior.
Not the direction you want to go is picked up on the street, and then those people are kind of the mentors rather than the people that would lift you up.
One of my mentors was Moxie. He was the local bookmaker, and my other influence was Jerry, who was also a bookmaker, and he's the first person who lent me money to buy marijuana. Other influences were people named Wingy, because he only had one good arm, so his nickname was Wingy. There was Fox. There was another gentleman named Fixie. And the gentleman that owned the candy store where I met all these people, where I got introduced to gambling and illicit behavior, his name was Ben. you know, we called him Benny. His name was Ben. He owned, his last name was Cooper. It was called Cooper's Corner, and it was owned by Benny Cooper. And when I had my son 40 years ago, I named him Benny after Benny Cooper, who I saw every day of my life because I hung out at the candy store because it was boring staying home alone. And I named my son after Benjamin Franklin because Benjamin Franklin, you know, who made his fame and fortune in Philadelphia, ended up on the $100 bill. And I wanted my son to emulate these people. And so, as you were saying, my influences were people on the street. I mean, we played a form of ball every day after school, you know, football in the winter, what we called handball, half ball, you know, the games that you play on the streets in Philly because you can't really hit a hard, you know, a baseball with a bat, but you can hit rubber balls with sticks, you know, which we did every day. And it was an education because they loved to go to movies. And sometimes I would get invited to take a ride downtown when I was like 15, 16 with these older guys, and we go see good movies, you know, in addition to James Bond. But they went to see foreign films, and it was a real education. I think that's maybe where my love of film started, which eventually propelled me, encouraged me, and inspired me to start a film festival 14 years ago. So the influences were broad. They weren't specifically, hey, so-and-so's away for the week, let's go rob their house. It wasn't like that. It was like...
Right.
None of them drank. I never saw any of these people take a drink. They all smoked cigarettes, which I didn't because I had a very bad case of asthma. So I was just scared to take a one puff of anything until I had my first puff of marijuana. But, you know, the rewards of a hit on marijuana are so much greater than a puff of a cigarette. So they all smoked, and they all gambled, and I became a compulsive gambler when I was in middle school. And there were times at lunch I'd be out in the schoolyard and some friends would drive up and say, hey, we're going to the racetrack. We're going over to New Jersey to Garden State Park. You want to come? And I would just walk out of the schoolyard, get in the car, and go to the racetrack. Because that was a lot more interesting than whatever was going to happen in school in the afternoon, where I would probably end up dozing off to a boring teacher. And being at the track was exciting. It was being in action. It was there's no boredom. There's no you're not thinking of your chores or homework or your asthma. You're thinking of winning, you know, putting the money on the right horse. And I can assure you that when you bet, a sizable amount of money, it doesn't matter, you know, to your own, you know, if I had $20 to my name and I bet $10 on a horse, which was a lot of money at that time, you know, from the time they rang that opening gate and the horse is running around, for that minute and 48 seconds, you're not thinking of dying. You're not thinking of sex. You're not thinking of anything other than the incredible Zen-like laser focus on the colors of the jockey's jersey going around the track. You don't even know if you're breathing. I don't even remember breathing. You're just so engrossed. It's a very distorted high form of meditation that I'm not recommending to anybody, but I know for a fact that my mother in her later life had a bad back, okay? But when I would take her to Atlantic City and she would get in front of a slot machine, she could play for 2 or 3 hours and experience no back pain whatsoever. because her focus was so involved in the cherries or the oranges or the sevens or, you know, the apples. I don't think they had apples. I don't think casinos want to remind you of anything healthy. She had no back pain. And I think people have a lot of addictive behaviors to escape one kind of pain or another. I know that I suffered from a little boredom growing up because my brother was sent away to boarding school, and I was home alone for 3 hours every day after school. But my mother worked. She had a job the whole time I was growing up because we had a mortgage to pay. And I had a very stable life in one great way. We never moved. We lived in the same house for 20 years. The neighbors never moved. It was very stable in that regard. While the rest of my life might have been experiencing chaos, but for those 3 hours, it was, you know, the TV at that time, we didn't have 87,000 channels to choose from. There was no DVD player. We didn't have a Betamax yet because it hadn't been invented. And all there was after-school TV, which was very boring. I didn't like game shows, and I didn't like soap operas. So I would go out and play ball or go out with my .22 caliber rifle that my father had left, and I would shoot things. I would shoot living objects, never a person and never a cat. But you know what I'm getting at. I'd shoot things. And I lived in a row house, you know, 50 houses put together. So I wasn't exactly hunting. And another thing I liked, which I didn't know you could make a living doing when you got older, I was a pyromaniac. I liked to set fires. I liked to see the glow of the fire and the smoke, you know. And you know, I set a couple fires that the fire engines had to be called for. I was scared to death. I ran and hid. But I liked setting fires, which I learned later from the guys. Hey, you know, you could have become an arsonist and made money. But I didn't know that at the time. So I did it for fun and for free.
Thank goodness.
And that's how I kept busy. And eventually I was blessed with the fact that where I grew up, there were 3 movie theaters that I could walk to. So every weekend, be it Saturday or Sunday or Saturday and Sunday, I could walk to a matinee double feature when we had double features and totally escape, but also be in the presence of some great actors and great filmmakers. You know, it was escape, but it was not worthless. You know, it was involved me, but I didn't think about being an only lonely child at that time, and you usually go with a friend, so it's fellowship. It's a way to do fellowship, and not to mention the candy, total sugar addict. I used to drink 6 little Coca-Colas a day. So you're at the movie theater, big screen, in the dark, Raisinets. A kid couldn't be happier. Of course, when the movie was over, I had to walk home with a sugar hangover. I didn't know that's what it was. I just thought I was really tired. And my first addictions were Coca-Cola and movies, maybe. What that has to do with anything, I don't have a clue at this moment.
My fault. You were going to... I'm sorry. You were going to read a thing, and I...
And how they took me to movies. And how that opened up my mind to other horizons. And the first time I went to Europe was, like, I couldn't believe that I flew to Israel, to the Holy Land, because I ran out of hashish. And I didn't know how to live without hashish. And there was no hashish in Philadelphia. There was no hashish in New York. And believe me, I tried to find it. And I was 20 years old, and I was in Philadelphia College at that time. And I convinced a friend of mine Joe Brodsky that, hey, we can't live without, I can't, you, neither can you, because we were both so addicted. They said, we flew to Israel to smuggle back hashish so we could get high, because we didn't know what else to do. So we flew, it was the longest flight on the planet at that time. Maybe there's longer ones now. But it was El Al. It was nonstop from New York to Tel Aviv. And we did it, and we did it, and we got it, and we came back. And it was a memory I'll never forget. Now, see, if I had had a father, he might have said to me, are you kidding? You can't go to Israel and smuggle hashish. You could get arrested and spend 20 years in prison if you get caught. No. You can't do that because I'll reprimand you. I'll take away your privileges or whatever. But I had a mother who loved me and thought that I think I was raising myself a little because she was at work every day. I mean, she knew what I was doing, and I guess she trusted me to do it well, which I suppose I did, because I had a tremendously mediocre dealing career, but I had it for many years. And mediocre means I never made a lot of money, but I never, you know, I never got, well, I got arrested, but I never got really busted. I got arrested once, but luckily the lawyer that we hired, well, actually my mother was arrested at the same time because they broke down the doors of our row house and they found some marijuana and they took us both in, and they let her go after they fingerprinted her. Me they kept, and we hired an attorney. He's probably gone by now. His name was Bob Simone. And he explained how it worked in Philadelphia. He said, this will cost you $3,000 to get out of. And we said, can you guarantee that? He said, yes, I just told you. It's $3,000. $750 for the judge. $750 for the prosecuting attorney. $750 for the defense attorney. And $750 for the mayor of Philadelphia. And we gave him the $3,000, went to court. The lawyer says, hello, how you doing, good morning. Judge says, not guilty, goodbye. It was a very efficient way to handle criminals in Philadelphia who had money. Of course, everybody else did time. But we had the... We knew where to go and what to do. So there is some advantages to being street smart. I think my mother was street smart.
Yeah.
I know she graduated high school, but she never went to college, but she was a pretty smart cookie, as they used to say. Although at this time,
right,
I feel there is nothing smart about cookies.
No.
Being a recovering sugar addict. Yeah.
Right.
It's
so
been
many
an
things to get.
Interesting journey, I must say, Kim. In terms of, I have an MRI scheduled for 2 weeks from now where they've been keeping an eye on a little bastard tumor that's been growing, where they'll compare it size to the size of my last MRI. Because I did have one removed about 10 years ago. And when they took
now
out
this
the tumor,
is your...
they took out my hearing mechanism in my left ear. So I'm I have a mono hearing device, which is called my right ear. And the only other creature on Earth that only has one ear is a praying mantis. So,
really?
I feel like I'm in good company. But every other kind of animal, fish, even insects, have two little things that they hear with. Well, I only have one thing, and I am so appreciative and grateful that I have it. And I know
the movie the other night won
the Best Picture of the Year called Coda, which I have not seen yet, and I know it stars a number of deaf people, and you know, I'm deaf in one ear, and I'm glad to have the one good one. It serves me really well, like it is now, being able to, you know, to hear you and to hear Michael, and it's something that I'm very grateful for. So.
Now, Leonard, yeah. just a second. Before you go on, only because you left out part of it, the audience might want to know about is the tumor was a brain tumor, and you had that brain tumor.
It was in my head. It was somewhere where they had to drill a hole. I just know I can send you, I should have sent you a picture of the stitches in my skull where they had to open it up and remove the tumor. And
your
face could be, you could lose muscle control on the side of your face. And the guy said he decided to take out the hearing mechanism rather than the nerve that controlled my face. So, you know, but I believe that the tumors might have been caused by smoking weed, ganja, marijuana every single day of my life for 26 years. And one of my gurus says, it swells the midbrain. And so I don't discount the fact that smoking marijuana for 26 years every single day might have had something to do with my tumors, because they got to come from somewhere for a reason. You know, I think everything happens physically for a reason. You know, I think 90% of the illnesses in America come from what people put down their throats into their stomachs. I see people at the supermarket, interesting-looking, seemingly educated mothers putting 12 packs of Pepsi into their cart to take home for their children to drink this highly toxic, you know, worthless beverage, and they're putting it into the stomachs of their children. And
a lot
you
of
wonder
sugar.
Why there's health. It's not health care, it's illness care. There's no health care in America. I'd say 9 out of 10 people's illnesses come from what they eat. And that could mean too much alcohol. But it definitely means soda is the beverage of America. It's a bizarre thing in my mind. Maybe I'm the only one of your listeners who thinks that every time you drink a soda, you're poisoning yourself. The body doesn't know what to do with that acid and those bubbles and that sugar and that artificial flavoring. It's not food. It's not, you're not feeding your temple, you know, grains and vegetables and carrots and fried eggs and you're just poisoning yourself. But yet, and so I think I was slowly poisoning my brain every day that I smoked 2 and 5 joints a day. And the new little thing, I've been seeing a Chinese herbalist, and I bang myself on the head. I tap myself on the head like this every morning saying, go away, little tumor, go away, little tumor, go away, little tumor, go away. You know, I don't know if that's going to work, but it sort of makes me feel good, and it feels like I'm doing something to help heal myself, even if I'm not successful. You know, as they say in that anonymous program of for alcoholics and narcotics addicts. And, you know, you do the best you can,
yeah,
and you stay out of the results. So I'm doing the best I can to get rid of this little bugger. And if I do, I do. If I don't, then I will let Western medicine do its best job to keep me alive, because that's the direction that I have to go. You know.
Now, when we talked the last time, you mentioned that initial brain tumor or head tumor that took your hearing, but you didn't mention that they were keeping their eye
on another. I don't share personal things on my social media. I am on Facebook if anybody wants to friend me or whatever. You know, Leonard Bushell, Facebook. By the way, the book that I wrote, it took me 10 years, but when you read it, you'll read it in a weekend, I promise. You will read it in a weekend. It has lots of photographs, poems, quotes. It's quite something that turned out better than I ever expected when I started it and in the middle of it. And, of course, when the COVID-19 thing came, I thought, I need to take this downtime to finish this book, and I did. And I crafted it in such a way where it's extremely entertaining, it's very funny, and I would hope informative and inspirational. If I can stop using drugs after using drugs every day for 26 years, and it's actually been 27 since I, you know, 27 clean and sober, remarkable, beyond a miracle. I don't know what can be beyond a miracle. Two miracles. A, that I got clean and sober. B, that I stayed that way. I think I can do it. If I can quit, my whole lifestyle had to change. And I think anybody can write a memoir. Anybody who has a desire or an inkling or a curiosity about who they are, just get a pad, get a yellow lawyer's pad, yellow or white, get a pencil that you can erase, and just start telling stories about yourself or about your family, about your schoolmates, about your best friend, about your music teacher, whatever. And just, you know, write down a couple hundred stories and then put them together in a really cohesive way. And you will have a memoir. It can be purely chronological, which mine isn't. Mine has a little, you know, chronological is interesting, but the way I did it is a little more interesting. You know, flashbacks, flash forwards. It's really, really, I'm so proud of it. I can't even say it because I'm proud of a lot of the things I've done. The 13-year-old film festival came out of nowhere, but it came from me, and it happened, and I've kept it going. And people love it. A week in New York, a week in Los Angeles. And the newsletter, which is 8.5 years, every single Tuesday, me and my associate editor publish a newsletter that is completely different every Tuesday at 9 o'clock Pacific Standard Time with 30 different articles about society and addiction and celebrities' sobriety and about movies and television shows that deal with this subject, including mental injury, you know, and societal ills. And it's fascinating, and it's different every week. We have 23,000 subscribers. Half of them open it every week.
Leonard, is that addiction recovery
ebulletin.org? Yes.
Okay, good. I just want to say that again.
I'll tell you how it's amazing how only by looking back at your life that you realize what, for me, I don't say you, but what made me the publisher and editor of the Addiction Recovery e-bulletin is the fact that growing up in Philadelphia, my mother had delivered every morning the Philadelphia Inquirer. So eating breakfast, you know, I would get to look at the sports scores or the amusement page is what they called it, to see what was playing at the movies, which meant so much to me. And in the afternoon, at noon, I'd go to, when on the weekends, because I was in school during the week, the Daily News, the Philadelphia Daily News, great paper, I'd get that. And then in the afternoon, 4 or 5 o'clock, the Evening Bulletin, the Evening Philadelphia Bulletin. And I would read all three sometimes every day. And so that's what gave me such an interest in news. News, you know, it's not all about hard news. It's not all about crime. There's feature stories about the Galapagos Islands. There's science stories. There's, you know, obituaries are fascinating. I get the New York Sunday Times every week, and I get it on Sunday. And I read it. And it's not the first thing I go to. Trust me, I'm not morbid. You know, after the front page and the art section, I go to the obituaries because it's fascinating stories about people. You know, it's usually very accomplished people that I've never heard of who did things interesting enough in their lives to have a big, you know, obit in the New York Times. And, of course, almost every other week there's you know, celebrity obituaries. Taylor Hawkins from the Foo Fighters. It's just a tragic time we live in that so many people die from wanting to get high. Hey, they just want to get high. I don't think they want to die. Maybe some people want to die from fentanyl, but most don't. So you have 100,000 people dying, half of whom probably got started on legal opiates prescribed by some idiot doctor, you know, who had, you know, in the old days, for getting a tooth pulled, you'd get 20 or 30 Percodans. They were just, it's crazy. Now I don't get any. I get a couple ibuprofen, Advil, if you will. So I don't want to talk about cases in America. I want to talk about, and I'm not going to talk about the, you know, the shortage of joy in America and why so many people are hard up to experience a little ecstasy, which I don't blame them. Because, you know, I smoked heroin only for about 6 months, and then I realized, oh, God, this could end tragically. You know, luckily I didn't graduate to shooting or even, you know, snorting it. I just smoked it.
You know, back in the time we're talking about, it isn't that
in the last century,
people didn't, you know, Janis Joplin and the guy from The Doors, it's not like there weren't celebrity ODs for sure. But it seems like, you know, back Studio 54 days when Coke was hot in the disco era and things like that.
Yes.
People have died from drugs all along, but it seems like this new fentanyl thing is getting put into pot, getting put into opioids, getting put into, mixed with, if you will.
Yes.
Every kind of drug that people are picking up, and from what they're saying, if you can, you know, believe the news, but I've read some of the science as well, is that fentanyl, I mean, if you thought Coke was very addictive that you found out when, what was it, crack came along.
Yeah.
That was really addictive. You know, people could be addicted in just a couple times of doing that. And now it appears that this fentanyl in one use can cause people to become addicted and or that people aren't counting on the fact that the pot that they're buying or a couple lines that they're doing is having this fentanyl mixed with it, and that it's a killer. I think you're right. They weren't planning on dying. They didn't even know they were doing fentanyl.
Yes. I think one of the most tragic things happening in America right now is that some college kids can go out to party, snort a line of coke, and die from it. That didn't happen back when I was coke, which I did. I did cocaine every single day for 13 years of my life. And if somebody tried that today, they wouldn't be. They wouldn't be able to. They would die. But back in the day, coke was coke. Maybe there was a little manite, which is the form of baby laxative. But hey, you know, going to the bathroom one more time isn't going to kill you. And I think that is one of the horror. You know, one of the great things about America is that marijuana is legal in so many places. So, you know, that's a good thing. That was one of the great social improvements, legal improvements that we've had. You know, that's like, you know, back when people were getting arrested for marijuana, that was like people getting arrested for homosexuality. It was barbaric. Barbarians, people will look back at these, at this last 100 years and think, they were throwing people into jail for smoking marijuana?
Well, the propaganda at the time was, you know, the reefer madness mentality.
Yes.
And
yes.
I'll just tell you, you know, I live in Nebraska, and our governor, with a scotch in one hand, coming from a very wealthy family of a scotch in one hand kind of people, our reefer madness, anti-pot, anti-cannabis.
Really?
Kind of, oh, very much so here. He's just been just horrible about it. And one of the things that I've heard so many times on this show, and remember, you know, this is Brain Injury Radio. There's a lot of people with brain injury, and many of those people and a lot of children have seizure disorders or pain disorders.
Right.
And I've had mothers on here that have tried everything the doctor could throw at them to help their kid from having 30 seizures a day.
Yeah.
And they heard from someone about, you know, cannabis oil, not the CBD, but with the THC in it. They gave their children, you know, these few drops of cannabis.
Yeah.
One lady in particular I can remember, because I couldn't believe that a child would be having like 30 to 40 seizures a day. And when this kid started using the cannabis, was down to, and this child was like 8, 9, 10 years old. Anyway, was down to having a couple seizures a month. From 30 to 40
What's
a day,
point?
And when you
that your governor is the devil.
Yeah,
the point is that your governor makes money from putting people in prison, mostly black or Latino or immigrants. You know, that's the point, and the point is hopefully that your people will vote him out of office
if
he runs or whatever.
He's on his way out. And, you know, he's not really busting, like you say, because it's been a misdemeanor for quite a while, but he just won't legalize it. But, you know, again, I go back to the reefer madness mentality and the fact of all of the people. It's really grated on me over my lifetime that they call cannabis the gateway drug. Your take is a little different than I've ever heard in my life before, because I have never known anybody who's picked up a joint who hasn't picked up alcohol first. You know,
right.
That didn't
or
maybe drink beer
or the
whatever
alcohol,
first.
And for the alcohol, masturbation.
Alcohol's the gateway drug. You know, alcohol's the gateway drug. Once you pick up alcohol, you're going to be more risk tolerant. And then if you're prone to, you know, going to be someone who's going to try drugs, you know, then you're going to go to the alcohol and to the coke and the whatever and keep going down that road. But, you know, when people like our governor comes on and has that same kind of thinking that was decades old as he sits there with the scotch in his hand, I just want to smack him upside the head. He doesn't have another chance. He'll be gone in the fall and someone new will be coming in, and I don't know whether they'll be for it. We're going to be getting it on the ballot, medicinal only, not recreational, in November, and we'll see. I think it may work, you know, but he did something nasty last time this came up for vote. They needed something like 85,000 signatures, and the senators or whoever they are, that I think two senators that were trying to get it on the ballot got like 135,000 signatures, and all they needed was 85. Well, he found some technicality in their paperwork, if you will, and wound up getting it not even on the ballot. And so, you know, it's sad you can't hang on to the ballot with all the signatures and try just shooting it back in again the next time you have a chance. But no, they had to start over.
First, to have the death penalty, you know.
I'm pretty sure.
What's that?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Okay, well, killing people with your money, because you pay for the electricity that courses through the man's or woman's veins or body sitting there in the electric chair. That's your money paying for the electricity. So I feel like an accomplice. You know, they used to have executions up in San Quentin near where I live. But can I read something from my book just to break it up a minute?
Sure.
Okay, here it is. Here it goes. This is chapter 10. And I want to read all the chapter titles, so it'll give people who might be thinking of buying High Confessions of a Cannabis Addict on Amazon a taste of what they're going to be reading. So this is chapter 10. Oh, Mama, can this really be the end? Parenting is not as easy as they make it sound, in the Good Housekeeping magazine. As easygoing as she was, my mother had her share of anxiety-provoking moments. Now, remember, my mother was not unaware of my vocational aspirations to become a drug dealer. Up until the age of 79, her age when I got sober, she always thought something bad would happen to me. There's an old saying that a mother can often share about a son like me. And the quote is, every time I hear the phone ring, I don't know if it's the hospital or the police calling, and I often picture you dead in a gutter. You know, that's a little extreme, but that's what she thought. I did have a death-defying incident that not even my mother's clairvoyance could have predicted. The incident was certainly drug-related. One night, at the age of 37, I was nocturnally socializing with my friend and roommate, Steve, and a friend of his in Studio City, snorting coke and downing endless bottles of Heineken. When I finally lay down to sleep, as the sun was coming up and those awful birds were starting to sing, I had a massive asthma attack brought on by dehydration and my completely collapsed bronchia. Luckily, we hadn't taken the 6 a.m. let's get to sleep now 10 milligram Valiums. When I fell against Steve's bedroom door, he was still awake. He saw that I was suffocating and completely blue. He immediately called 911. I was dying. I could see myself dying, and I didn't want to die. I was dead set against it. It was the worst, most horrible and frightening experience of my entire life. While dying, I was being catapulted through deep space, a million miles of the darkest hell imaginable. I was almost dead, seconds from the end. No white light, no tunnel shimmering a beckoning plea. I was silently screaming in unimaginable darkness, blackness much blacker than that, screaming, screaming into the abyss. An abyss so dark and frightening, so horrifying, flying through the tunnel of death with no return. But I did. I did return, that is. I saw my son's DNA floating in the cosmos, and I knew I had to make it back. I fought the will of death with all my might. I could not let Ben grow up without me. I wasn't going to become my father. The next thing I was conscious of was my mother's voice. But she lived in Philadelphia, so where was I? Maybe I had died. Then I heard other voices and realized I couldn't see. I was blind. I thought I was blind. I didn't know it, but my eyelids had been taped shut. I heard the nurse's voices saying, he's conscious now. She peeled the tape off my eyelids. They had taped them shut because the doctors had given me so much adrenaline and morphine that my eyelids wouldn't close, hence my eyeballs would have dried up and cracked. My throat was in excruciating pain. The nurse had just taken the ventilator out of my throat after 2 days of having it breathe for me to keep me alive. I later found out that the North Hollywood Medical Center had called my mother in Philadelphia. I'm in Los Angeles at this time. Had called my mother in Philadelphia and told her she better be on the next flight to L.A. because there was a 50-50 chance she'd be flying home with her son's body. The doctor later told me that if 911 had been called a half hour later, I would have died in the ambulance because it would have been slowed down by the traffic on Riverside Drive. I was minutes from being pronounced DOA. I had 2 sons, 8 and 10 years old at the time. Imagine how different their lives would have been if I'd never woken up from almost dying. So that's just one little blip on my journey from childhood to sobriety. And I have to tell your listeners, I didn't get sober for 5 years after that. That horrible experience did not translate to, oh, you have to stop using drugs and drinking. What it did was made me switch from vodka to Bombay gin. That was the deal I made. But I never once thought of quitting or even slowing down that much. I never once thought of quitting drinking and using drugs. That's how amazingly profound the grips of addiction are. That experience, you know, you talk about hitting bottom. I almost hit bottom and kept going right to hell or heaven, but it didn't stop me from using. It never even crossed my mind. So the fact that 5 years later, I ended up driving myself to a rehab and staying there for 28 days and never picking up a drink or a drug again is something, you know, it should be a movie. I mean, if it was a movie, I wouldn't believe it. I would say, this is bullshit. I would walk out. This is like ridiculous. This couldn't possibly happen unless someone was telling a biblical tale where suddenly in the middle of the desert there was a spring feeding me the freshest water I could imagine, and I no longer would have to expire from the sunshine and the desert. that's sort of the equivalent to what I felt like, because I never intended to stop using drugs when I went to rehab. I backed into the rehab, literally in my car, my Volvo. I backed in. I went there because I thought I was having a nervous breakdown over a breakup with the woman I was, you know, insanely in love with. I thought the police were going to arrest me for something, and that was not paranoia. I was never paranoid. Let me say that. I knew that I could be arrested any day of the week, any day, morning, noon, or night, for the toll. I only dealt drugs for 23 years, but I knew every day they wanted to arrest me. So I never suffered from paranoia. But getting to the rehab was nervous breakdown, thinking I was going to be arrested, and thought, it'll look good in front of the judge if they take me out of a rehab. Luckily, that didn't happen. And, you know, what got taken out of the rehab was a clean and sober Leonard Bushell, whose book, High, Confessions of a Cannabis Addict, is available at Amazon 24 hours a day, because the city doesn't sleep. The internet never shuts down. It's an incredible, you know, is it better now than it was 40 years ago? You know, are we better off now than we were 40 years ago? I don't know. I love, it's like the great English writer Martin Amis said, he says, what did he say about the 20th century? He said, he didn't just love it, he was addicted to it. You know, addicted to how everything has gotten so easy and so fast. There are Amazon grocery stores, probably using the name Whole Foods, that they bought, that they're trying out in several cities, that if you have Apple Pay and you have it on your iPhone, you can literally walk through a grocery store, load up your cart, and walk out of the store, and they know what you took, and they charge your credit card. Now, is that a good thing? Or are you missing the interaction with the checkout cashier? Are you missing the human contact of you know, asking the cashier, hey, why is that so much? You know, whatever repartee you have with the cashier. Or, hey, are you busy after work? You know, whatever you might be saying to the cashier. And they're going to do away with that. It's insane. You know, I think the whole purpose of the internet, the whole challenge for not Elon Musk, but him too, everybody, Jeff Bezos, his main goal in life is to sell you something online and to see how fast he can get your money out of your bank account into his bank account. It is so easy. One touch, buy now, pay now. You can. I shop once in a while out of loneliness or frustration, especially during the pandemic. If I the Amazon driver, he knows who I am. I know who he is. I know who he's. You know, they're the most important people in my life. Plus the people that put on Netflix and HBO and Amazon Prime, how you can be entertained anytime, anywhere, on your phone, anyway. But the point is that they just want to see how fast they can get your money from your bank account into their bank account. And I can literally think of something before I go to sleep and say, I need new pens, and I did it today. I love these Japanese pens. And I went to my computer, and in less than a minute, I had bought 12 of them, $7 for three. So I spent $21. I get free delivery because I'm a Prime member. But it happened so fast. You know, it's like sometimes I think I see the guy delivering things, and I don't even remember what I ordered because I was in some sort of shopper's blackout. And I love everything. I said, I didn't get a delivery today. I feel a little changed as a human. You know, something's missing in my life. I don't even know what it is that they were going to be delivering. I knew it would make me happy because my goal was to be happy. And being on your radio show.
I'm sorry, Litter.
I mean, happy.
It is.
In fact, I have a friend visiting from Humboldt County right now, and she's sitting across the room. And as long as I can keep her smiling, I will say anything I have to, but I will not use the F word. And to me, the only dirty word right now is war. And I haven't said it once. I just said it, and I'm sorry I said it, because God knows it's nice to get through an hour without thinking about apartment houses being bombed and schools being bombed and nurses dying, helping their countrymen survive. You know, they say, oh, war crimes. War is the crime. Don't give me this war time. Say, war crimes. Yes, war is a crime. And that's why John Lennon, you know, I'm so glad he's not here to see this. And Matt, you know, peace. And then that great song, which is his name I forget. Imagine all the people living in peace. Well, it's hard to right now. It's really hard to, you know. And you lay a pandemic on us, and now you lay a war, just as we think the pandemic is ending. It's hard to have a completely happy day unless you're so focused on your art or sex or loving someone or your pets, your animals, your gardening. Hopefully when you're gardening, you're not thinking of atrocities. You're thinking of bringing live vegetables and flowers into the world. And I don't have a flower box, but I have flowers, meaning I don't have one of those herb gardens, because I'm not good with that. But I do have flowers, and I have plants, and I water them, and I think it's the least I can do. And I have one ritual that I don't share. You know, I wouldn't share this on CNN, but I'll share it with you and your audience. Every morning, I have a ritual where before I do anything else, I sit at my altar, which is a little piece of a big piece. I wish there was a piece, a little picture of Jesus the Christ, and I have a little water, a little rice, and a little salt, because that's all you really need to live. And I light incense, and I offer the sweetness to God, in case. And I always say, "Dear God, here is some sweetness, in case I don't offer you anything else sweet today, like a kind word or a friendly gesture." So at least to get it out of the way. I never feel guilty about not giving God something that God wants. And I won't say he or she, but I'm sure God is trans, I would assume. And so I just light some incense and say, hey, here's some sweetness. And then at night I light a different incense based on a Japanese incense that always helps put me to sleep. And then I say to the night, night sky, little birds, little nocturnal animals, you know, clouds, here's a little sweetness. And then I can go to sleep and feel like, well, I did my chores today. You know, I did my chores. And, you know, my main guru, I think, his name is Misho Kushi. Japanese guy. Someone said, is he dead? I said, he's not really dead. His body is dormant, but I'm sure his spirit is doing something somewhere. And he said, you can say you've had a successful day. If at the end of the day you say to yourself, yes, I ate good food today, you know, healthy, local, preferably organic food. And if you say to yourself, I chewed my food, like Gandhi said, chew your liquids and drink your foods. So if I chewed my food well, which he suggests is 50 to 100 times per mouthful. The third thing is, did I acknowledge my ancestors today? Did I thank them for enabling me to be alive. And the fourth thing was, he said, would I live this day, would I like to live this day over again? And if you can say yes to those fourth questions, you've had a hell of a day. And if there's anybody still listening, trust me, I don't often say yes to all those things. But occasionally I do. And I feel like I hit the spiritual jackpot. And every day that I don't pick up a drug or a drink, you know, I'm a winner. I always say, for me, quitting being a drug dealer was like walking away from a craps table with $1 million and not going back and losing it. And so, you know, the every day is ultimately not a bad day. They're great days. They're good days. There's very few average days, especially since I've been watching some great TV series. There's one on HBO about the Lakers. And there's one about the woman who founded that company, Theranos, raised $34 billion for a piece of equipment that she knew never worked. This woman had chutzpah. I love her. And her name is Elizabeth Holmes. She just got convicted.
Yeah.
She's being sentenced in September. And there's a couple great documentaries about her, Elizabeth Holmes. The one I recommend is called Something Blood. Anyway, I'm going on and on because I'm about to have a low blood sugar pre-diabetic experience. So I'm going to ask Kim to just sum up everything I've been trying to say in 2 minutes or less before I actually have a bad health episode, because I didn't eat before the show, and I'm going to get dizzy. I'm actually holding a real phone, not a cell phone, and I'm afraid I'm going to drop it, and it's going to break. It's an old Panasonic. It's 20 years old. It's not an antique, because it has to be 100 years old to be an antique, but it is a relic of another time. It's an old Panasonic, and I'm going to drop it. So I am getting faint, and I don't want to faint on the air, because without the visual, it would be boring.
No, please don't faint on the air. Please don't faint on the air. And I just want to thank you for all that you've contributed, and I hope you get some sugar so you don't faint at all. But tonight, Leonard Bushell has been speaking. He's the author of High, Confessions of a Cannabis Addict, that can be found on Amazon. He's got a couple of websites, leonardbushell.com, addictionrecoveryebulletin.org. I encourage you to check that out. And Real, like in the movies, R-E-E-L, Real Recovery Film Festival. org. And Leonard shared with us tonight about his drug addiction, many addictions actually. I think you'll find in real life that addictions, if you have a predilection toward addiction, that your addictions can be whether it's sex, drugs, shopping, cannabis, the harder drugs. I think the 12 steps program, the initial one, has been borrowed by 173 different organizations, whether it's for overeating, gambling, or the other 171. So tonight, Leonard shared a story of hope and recovery and how easy it is to go down the wrong road and get stuck there, and that it's not an easy climb out of the hole, but your options are death, a totally messed up brain, disability, jail, or recovery. And when you clear yourself of the blockages that addiction brings and leave room for the light of the spirit, you can completely transform your life. I think Leonard just fainted because he dropped off of the board, but I sure hope not. But that was my summation of what Leonard had to say tonight. And so I'm going to talk. I see Michael's still there, and I might bring him on. Michael is also an author. One of the things that Leonard talked about, and Michael, if you stay, I'll let you come back on for the end if you're not asleep. But one of the things he brought up was that anybody can write a book. And I'm glad that he took the time, the 10 years he said it took to write his book. It is a gratifying experience. Michael, who was on in the beginning talking about his victory for everyone who goes to visit Pinellas County, who wasn't able to access a beach before, now can, largely because of his efforts. Michael started out, and he wrote 3 books, believe it or not, and I wrote 2 books. So I will concur with our guest Leonard and say that if you have something you want to say, if Michael can do it, and I can do it, and Leonard can do it, you can surely do it. So take out your yellow pad like he suggested. And the idea of writing a whole book can be really overwhelming when you think of it in totality and where do I begin and oh my God, the feelings you think before you get started. But I tell you, if you jot down a little bit at a time, jot down your profound thoughts as they come, and you write a little bit every day. Now, I didn't do that. I'll tell you what my style was, but what most writers will tell you, authors will tell you, is that if you get in the habit of writing by jotting down a couple of your thoughts every day, and you make that a habit, that when you get to the point of writing a book, you put those thoughts together and it comes to you much easier. With me, because I've always been a little contrary, when I wrote my 2 books, I did it the same way. I thought about it for a long time. And when I made the decision to sit down and write, it was like an exorcism. I sat down and I wrote at the exclusion of my normal amount of sleep, my normal amount of eat, and about anything else. It was a thought consciousness that once I put the pen down, I wanted to go from the beginning to the end and tell a story like what Leonard said. And so my books aren't long, but they're easily readable from the beginning to the end because it's just how I sat down and wrote them out like an exorcism and put down my pen at the end and they were done and published. So one last thing I'd like to say about Leonard, and this being the end of, for me anyway, although I'm just checking the date. Are there 31? Yeah. Tomorrow will be the last day. But for me, this is the last day on air of Brain Injury Awareness Month. And it's been a really incredible month. For us survivors, Awareness Month is every month, every day, every month, every year. We're aware of brain injury because we live with it. But these Brain Injury Awareness Months are to help other people and the newcomer become more aware, and even us old timers hearing new information from other people. And I actually started on my last show in April with Simon. We kind of kicked off Brain Injury Awareness Month starting the next day or whatever it was. And we did it, the show, on falls, which is huge. About 46% of the brain injuries that happen are as a result of a fall. And we did an entire show just on falls. And then the first week, Dr. Maria Romanis was on, and we talked about the joy switch. And that was how to have a positive attitude. Dr. Maria is a brain injury survivor, and in the beginning of the show, we talked about the joy switch and how to have a positive attitude, which Michael talks a lot about, and that's a way you really got to have one to make it through this journey of brain injury. And then we talked about some of the other pieces of the pie in that second hour, the first week of Brain Injury Awareness Month, and talked about things a little bit. 2.8 million people a year have brain injuries. That ABI falls under TBI, at least on the Brain Injury Awareness Association page. And a TBI is something that originates outside your head, like getting hit directly in the head or falling and hitting your head. Or even in the case of concussion, it can be like a whiplash concussion where you don't actually make, your head doesn't make contact with something external, but you're caused to have your neck snap and your brain bounces from the back of your skull to the front of your skull or vice versa, where your brain is like jello and your skull is like a spiny, sharp, like a cage. And that causes problems. Domestic violence, car accidents, all kinds of ways to incur TBIs. In week two, I had on somebody who's become an extremely dear friend of mine. I love them to death, Ray Ciancanglini, and he's the former professional boxer that I had on, who sent me a boxing glove and a very cool poster that looks like the front of his book, Second Impact. And that was important to understand a few different things. Ray lives up in New York, and he and his wife, Patty, are just really salt-of-the-earth people, and it was my pleasure and honor to have him on and become friends with him. Kind of like Ron in the chat and Michael on the switchboard, although I've known the last two for decades, anyway. And Ray, I just met a couple months ago, but it feels, he's one of those people you feel like you've known forever. But second impact is when you have a concussion that was not fully healed and you're in sports, generally, in his case, boxing, went back in too soon, took another bad hit to the same place. That's what second impact is about. And it immediately gave him post-concussion syndrome problems in his early life from when that happened, probably kept him from being a champion. He was never knocked down and well on his way as a professional boxer toward that objective, but then got that second impact. And now, at around 70, many years later, he is diagnosed with probable CTE and Parkinson's syndrome. So we talked about concussion, second impact, the importance of safety protocols, and how brain injuries now, repeated brain injuries now, and that doesn't mean just in sports. It means one reason you might want to keep your kid out of contact sports is because it ain't just sports where you get brain injuries. And too many of those together, not together, but when you have too many of those brain injuries now, you can not only suffer the effects now, but have it morph into a degenerative disease later. The next week in the show, which was last week, very interesting information on a clinical trial, phase 2 clinical trial. If you're in the Midwest around the Kansas City area, you can look at last week's show on braininjuryradio.com or my inaflash.org page where I have programs, and look at last week's show, and you'll hear Dr. Michael Wyand talk about the second phase clinical trial. That's for a drug that will be released after this second phase trial, hoping that it goes as well as the first phase went. And that, if taken pretty promptly after suffering a concussion, will mitigate those after effects of concussion, and hopefully, and I'm not the doctor or the scientist, just kind of recapping Brain Injury Awareness Month and what we've talked about here on Recovery Now, may help people not go through the degenerative diseases later on if, and I'll add this, you know, they take that pill and it mitigates the concussion symptoms and then you stop that sport. I don't concur with a lot of the others that say, you know, and then you let the concussion heal and then you go back and ask for more. So I'm a little bit different there. But in any case, it's an exciting message of hope to know that there is someone out there working on a solution for one of our problems, because so many of us have been run around in the traditional medical model for years about our various brain injuries and haven't gotten much satisfaction or much help. Little therapy, not too helpful a lot of times. Drugs pelted at us, finally landing on the shrink's couch, and none of that helps what we in searching for in the first place. And so there is hope that there are people out there working to help make things better. After Dr. Wyand was done talking last week, I was very fortunate to have a former professional football player on, and he's from the CTE Worldwide Facebook page that Chris runs, and that was Rico Petrini who was my guest. Now, he was very interesting because he suffered sports repeated concussions in his younger days. But his, unlike Ray, whose damage manifests instantly and early and young in life, Rico actually went something like 30 years before all of a sudden his brain started going haywire and started having the symptoms that a lot of us have: impulse control problems sometimes, sleep issues, cognitive dysfunction, short-term memory loss. And he took part in a clinical study of another kind. I'm trying to think of what it was called. Anyway, if you look up last week's show, you'll see, and all of these shows that I'm talking about, all of our shows on Brain Injury Radio go from live to on demand. And if you've come in ever and you've just heard part of the show and you don't want to listen to the whole 2 hours, but you want to hear the part you missed, if you go to braininjuryradio.com and go to the on-demand section, or in the case of my shows, I post them all over social media if you happen to have that, or if you like my inaflash.org Facebook page, or go to my website, inaflash.org, or like the Brain Injury Radio page, you can click on a link. It'll bring the show up again, the same link that you clicked on to listen to the live show will take you to the on-demand show, and there's a little slider underneath with a timer on it. The shows are 2 hours, so that would be, 120 minutes. So you just slide the slider across. Maybe you were here for the first hour and you fell asleep for the second hour. Just slide the little slider over to the 60-minute point or whatever point you might have cut out or you want to re-listen to. And you can do that, pardon me, without having to listen to the whole show over again. Or certainly, if you missed out on a show, like any of these I mentioned, and you'd like to hear more about them, then go back and listen to the shows on demand. And then tonight, I wanted to talk about TBI and substance abuse. Now, Leonard did have a brain tumor, and he talked tonight and shared information about his book. What I would like to, I did capsulize what he said as he requested, but what I would also like to say, and my intent in bringing up this topic, was that substance abuse permeates the brain injury community in three different places. So we really have to be careful because it's like a landmine. The first place is that many people incur their TBI while they're under the influence, whether it's alcohol or a drug or whatever it is. Many times the fall, the car accident, or even drinking enough. I've had guests on in the past who have drank enough that they got alcohol poisoning that stopped their heart long enough to deprive their brain of oxygen, causing an anoxic brain injury, which is from lack of oxygen to the brain. And so there's so many injuries that can happen. You guys all, if not yourself, when you were drinking, known how your judgment is impaired. You all know people who, you know that you've seen them impaired when they were drinking and using drugs, know they're not in their right mind using their best judgment, and have done something that has resulted into a life-changing brain injury. So sometimes substance abuse is a causal factor for a brain injury. Then there's the middle stage when a person is being treated for a brain injury, regardless of how they got it. Maybe they got it from substance abuse, maybe they got it another way, but they're at the point of treatment and maybe have had surgery or casts, broken their bones, whatever it might have been, and they're in the hospital and they start taking pain medication in the hospital, but then are still taking pain medication when they get out of the hospital and they wind up getting hooked on opioids or anti-anxiety drugs. And that goes on for a while and people try switching doctors when their doctor will no longer prescribe their drug of choice. And that is against the law, by the way. If you get caught, that's called kiting or shopping doctors. I believe that's a felony, so that's not something that you want to do. I encourage you to seek help if you ever find yourself in that position. Other people hit the streets instead of hitting the doctors when they get addicted to that medication. And one thing Leonard did allude to is how much more lethal drugs have gotten now, in the here and now, than they were back in the 80s. People still died back in the 80s from excessive usage, but today people can die doing it one time because it's laced with this horrible poison, fentanyl, which just kills instantly. And so a person might be going out to find some kind of an opioid lookalike, like heroin is one that a lot of soccer moms and others will wind up seeking when they can no longer get pain meds from their doctor. Or perhaps the cannabis. And I am with Leonard about legalizing it, because if it's legal, you have the choice not to take it, just like you can not take any prescription a doctor orders out. But a lot of pharmaceuticals have some super bad side effects. And if someone, they say there's not enough science, but boy, if science were radio shows, I could give you a lot of it. And I'm not a doctor, just my opinion from what I've heard from hundreds of people on these shows, that measured amounts supervised by a doctor of medicinal cannabis doesn't have the same side effects as a lot of these opioids do that people are going out and taking. And so, anyway, the treatment stage of TBI is another place where people can really get into trouble with substance abuse. And afterward, a person finds out that they thought they were broken. They knew they were broken. They thought they got fixed, were ready to go back to their life as they knew it, and they did not get the opportunity to do that because their brain injury was a game-changing event. So it takes a while to grieve and process all that, and they know they can't go back eventually to life as they knew it before, but they haven't figured out what the future is going to look like yet. And that's a dark hole, and it's scary, and you don't know which direction to go to build a new life. And people will start self-medicating at that point because they're depressed and they're scared and they're angry and they're frustrated. All kinds of mishmash of emotions going on from the injury, and they just want it to shut up, and they just want the answers. And they'll start drinking or using whatever is handiest to do to try to make them themselves feel better in an artificial way through alcohol or drugs. So my point in doing this show tonight was that substance abuse and TBI are a deadly mix. They truly are, because our brain gets changed when we have our brain injury. And if you add alcohol or drugs to that in excess, our judgment is going to be impaired on top of the impairment we've already incurred from our brain injury. And that can cause another deadly event in our life or create an addiction in our life. And one of the points that Leonard made is that addictions are very hard to, and they can be a deal breaker that messes up your life and a big hole to crawl out of And, you know, wherever you run, you're taking yourself with you. So there's no escape. When you become an addict, whether it's before, during, or after, all of the above or one of the above, you've got a big problem because you're either going to, and this is statistically proven, you're either going to die, wind up in jail, or you're going to get sober, clean and sober. And I vote that you make that last choice. I vote that you actually don't even have to go down that road because a brain injury is enough to deal with. It's plenty enough to deal with. But to take that side road down a negative path does not make the brain injury better, and it gives you another big problem to solve and to try to live through. Because the temporary relief you get is just that, it's temporary. And eventually it'll stop working. And then you've got an addiction disorder as well as a brain injury. And if you get help and you get through getting sober and you don't have that addictive disorder anymore, God bless, and that's great. But you still got the brain injury. So what you did is you gave yourself one more, picked up one more shovel to dig one more hole when you did that addiction. And when you get out of it, then you can seek a life worth living and find out about the new me and get help from other like-minded people here in support groups, live or virtual, on any of the many support pages on social media, through other like-minded friends that you meet, live or virtually, who have gone down the same road. It's important, if you don't have a good support group, find yourself and build yourself a support group. You're going to find that to be much more productive in the long run, to have those people surrounding you rather than the people that take you down the wrong path and encourage you to hurt yourself and to not support you in a healthy way. What we all need is someone who cares, someone who will validate, and someone who understands. And nobody understands like another survivor. And so, again, this has been Brain Injury Awareness Month for me. I think we've covered just about everything having to do with brain injury this month, and I hope that you've gotten something out of that. All of the hosts on Brain Injury Radio, and we got 90 seconds, are folks with brain injury, but we can talk about anything we want. Most of the time, it's brain injury. Next week, I have a guest on, and we're going to talk about something that's gone on for a long time, but like the fentanyl issue, it's gotten to be a very heavy-duty issue, not so much to do with the brain, but we're going to talk about sex trafficking and how to recognize that so we can try to clean that up and make our country a better place. I want to thank you all for listening tonight. Good night. God bless. My mics are all going to cut in just a moment. I appreciate and love all of you. It was difficult to do the show tonight. We had to put our dog Benny, turn him over to the angels last night. It's been a really hard 24 hours, but thank you all so much for your support for me all of these years and the show and for Brain Injury Radio. I wish you guys all a good week until, again, I'm your host, Kim Justice. I'll be back next Wednesday night, and I appreciate you all being here. And again, great job, Michael. Ciafone, I'm really looking forward to the PinellasCounty.org site and seeing his ribbon cutting. So I'm going to close with a song called Heaven by Chris Duke's band. It happened to have been his birthday in the last few days, and I'm afraid I might not have made it on Facebook to say happy birthday to him. It was kind of hard watching our beloved dog wind down and going through the last few days. But happy birthday to Chris Dukes, and here's a song called Heaven. Good night, everybody, and thanks so much.
Feel not enough. This love can get so rough. What have I gotten in? This is not heaven. Let the story be told. How happening once is, the other is cold. When the past comes to walk in, it makes it harder to tell. I dive into the water, hope you wish me well. In the dark night, I feel alone and I wonder, how do I make the wrong right? There's so many feelings, so many times, they grew it to life before the dark. This is not heaven, the story be told. How happening once is, the other is told. When the past comes to walk it, it makes it harder to tell.
You know, I would be remiss, apologies, I'm back again for a minute. With it being Brain Injury Awareness Month, I did want to wish ChrisDukesBand.com, Chris Dukes, a happy birthday, but I am going to close, as I should, the end of Brain Injury Awareness Month with our sponsor, TBI Survivor Network, and Craig, who founded our network, 13 years ago. We've been going strong, and he did it once a week for a year and a half or so, and then made it a 7-night-a-week proposition, and I've been here since then. I urge you to go to the website, theinsane.com, theinsane.com. Craig has, that's his band. They were traveling, and touring, I should say, and that's a lot of what went to fund our network staying on the air. And a couple things happened. The pandemic happened. It ended touring, which ended a large source of what funds our network. And then his 15-year drummer happened to pass away from COVID. So it was when they had just finished a three-album set and were ready to go on their farewell tour, which was going to be rather lengthy. The tour never happened. Thankfully, all three albums did get out, and The R Insane has a ton of music on it. If you flip through there and find something that you like, I encourage you to add it to your playlist. Every little bit helps. Every little bit adds up. So I'm going to close with aptly, Brain Injury Road. And again, good night, good bless, God bless, and we'll see you next week. Guess I'm getting tired too.
So
you can, the best you can, and I know you can.